98 deaths. Recovered, 4,062. Active, 625. Midland County, 3,707 confirmed cases with 83 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, 3,217 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 27th. 136 more than a week ago, they occupy 5.6% of hospital beds. 1,292 new cases were reported on September 27th. The latest positivity rate is 6.15%. 15,522 Texans have died as of September 27th. 37 more deaths reported than the day before and 629 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $40.12, down 13 cents. First, we'll look at coronavirus briefs. The number of coronavirus cases reported in the United States topped 7 million over the weekend. At least 204,000 fatalities have been recorded nationwide, and the global death toll is on the brink of reaching 1 million. The United States could see an explosion in COVID-19 cases as fall and winter set in, health experts warn. More than 35,000 airline employees will be out of a job on Thursday as the industry faces its worst crisis since the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. India is on track to overtake the United States as the country with the most coronavirus cases next month if current trends hold, and hospitals are struggling to secure adequate supplies of oxygen. Even with the infection numbers rising, European nations are finding that outbreaks linked to schools are few and far between. A third federal judge on Sunday ordered the U.S. Postal Service to halt changes that delayed mail delivery, the latest judicial rebuke to service cuts that critics allege would suppress mail-in voting in November's elections. One in three parents won't get flu vaccine for their child during pandemic, study finds. Dr. Anthony Fauci said COVID-19 vaccinations could very likely start in November or December, but it could still be a while until the U.S. is back to normal. Inovio's planned 2-3 COVID-19 vaccine trial on partial hold to answer FDA questions, company says. Here are some short articles. Nearly half of U.S. states are reporting increased numbers of new COVID-19 cases. Almost half of U.S. states are reporting increased numbers of new COVID-19 cases as health experts warn of a potential coronavirus surge in the fall and winter. According to the latest Johns Hopkins University data, 21 states are showing an upward trend in cases compared to the previous week. 19 states are showing steady trends. 10 states are showing downward trends. The U.S., meanwhile, could see an explosion of COVID-19 cases in the fall and winter as people exercise less caution and spend more time indoors, where there is a greater likelihood of transmission, according to Dr. Chris Murray, director of the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME. Murray says the IHME model shows a huge surge expected to take off in October and accelerate in November and December. The IHME model indicates that the country is currently seeing about 765 daily deaths from COVID-19, but that number could jump to 3,000 daily deaths by late December. CDC director concerned Atlas is sharing misleading information with Trump. NBC News reported Monday that U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Robert Redfield was overheard during a phone call in public on a commercial airline saying everything he says is false. NBC News, which heard the comment, said Redfield acknowledged after the flight from Atlanta to Washington, D.C., that he was speaking about Dr. Scott Atlas, a neuroradiologist who joined the White House Coronavirus Task Force in August. NBC said that Redfield, in the conversation with a colleague on Friday, suggested Atlas is providing President Trump with misleading data about the efficacy of masks young people's susceptibility to the coronavirus, and herd immunity. In this statement to CNN, a CDC spokesman did not deny the conversation took place. NBC News is reporting one side of a private phone conversation by CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield that was overheard on a plane from Atlanta-Hatfield Airport. Dr. Redfield was having a private discussion regarding a number of points he has made publicly about COVID-19. A federal health official tells CNN more broadly, bottom line, the story is accurate. CNN has reached out to the White House for comment. CNN has reported that Atlas, a critic of severe lockdowns, who has supported herd immunity strategies against the coronavirus, has found himself at odds with other medical experts in his administration, including Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Deborah Birx. On Friday, Fauci said during an interview that the Trump administration has pivoted away from receiving daily guidance from the White House Coronavirus Task Force to focus more heavily on the economy. We're meeting now on an average of one or at most two times a week, Fauci said. Now let's move to our longer articles. These first two articles were referenced by our pastor in his sermon yesterday as my wife and I watched our church service on TV. Your surge capacity is depleted. It's why you feel awful. Here's how to pull yourself out of despair and live your life. This was written by Tara Hale and published August 17th. It was the end of the world as we knew it, and I felt fine. That's almost exactly what I told my psychiatrist at my March 16th appointment, a few days after our children's school district extended spring break because of the coronavirus. I said the same at my April 27th appointment, several weeks after our state's stay-at-home order. Yes, it was exhausting having a kindergartner and fourth grader doing impromptu distance learning while I was barely keeping up with work. And it was frustrating to be stuck at home nonstop, scrambling to get in grocery delivery orders before slots filled up, and tracking down toilet paper. But I was still doing well because I thrive in high-stress emergency situations. It's exhilarating for my ADHD brain. As just one example, when my husband and I were stranded in Peru during an 8.0 magnitude earthquake that killed thousands, we walked around with a first aid kit, helping who we could and tracking down water and food. Then I went out with my camera to document the devastation as a photojournalist and interview Peruvians in my broken Spanish for my hometown paper. Now we were in a pandemic, and I'm a science journalist who has written about infectious disease and medical research for nearly a decade. I was on fire, cranking out stories, explaining epidemiological concepts in my social networks, trying to help everyone around me make sense of the frightening circumstances of a pandemic and the anxiety surrounding the virus. I knew it wouldn't last. It never does. But even knowing I would eventually crash, I didn't appreciate how hard the crash would be or how long it would last or how hard it would be to try to get back up over and over again or what getting up even looked like. In those early months, I, along with the rest of the country, was using surge capacity to operate, as Ann Mastin, Ph.D., a psychologist and professor of child development at the University of Minnesota, calls it. Surge capacity is a collection of adaptive systems, mental and physical, that humans draw on for short-term survival in acutely stressful situations, such as natural disasters. But natural disasters occur over a short period, even if recovery is long. Pandemics are different. The disaster itself stretches out indefinitely. The pandemic has demonstrated both what we can do with surge capacity and the limits of surge capacity, says Mastin. When it's depleted, it has to be renewed. But what happens when you struggle to renew it because the emergency phase has now become chronic? In my May 26th psychiatrist appointment, I wasn't doing so hot. I couldn't get any work done. I'd grown sick of Zoom meetups. It was exhausting and impossible to think with the kids around all day. I felt trapped in a home that felt as much a prison as a haven. I tried to conjure the motivation to check email, outline a story, or review interview notes, but I couldn't focus. I couldn't make myself do anything. Work, housework, exercise, play with the kids for that whole week. Or the next. Or the next. Or the next. I know depression, but this wasn't quite that. It was, as I'd soon describe in an emotional post in a social media group of professional colleagues, an anxiety-tainted depression mixed with ennui that I can't kick, along with a complete inability to concentrate. I spoke with my therapist, tweaked medication dosages, went out daily for fresh air and sunlight, tried to force myself to do some physical activity, and even gave myself permission to mope for a few weeks. We were in a pandemic, after all, and I had already accepted in March that life wouldn't be normal for at least a year or two. But I still couldn't work, couldn't focus, hadn't adjusted. Shouldn't I be used to this by now? Why do you think you should be used to this by now? We're all beginners at this, Maston told me. This is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It's expecting a lot to think we'd be managing this really well. It wasn't until my social media post elicited similar responses from dozens of high-achieving, competent, impressive women I professionally admire that I realized I wasn't in the minority. My experience was a universal and deeply human one. An unprecedented disaster. While the phrase adjusting to the new normal has been repeated endlessly since March, it's easier said than done. How do you adjust to an ever-changing situation where the new normal is indefinite uncertainty? This is an unprecedented disaster for most of us that is profound in its impact on our daily lives, said Maston. But it's different from a hurricane or tornado where you can look outside and see the damage. The destruction is, for most people, invisible and ongoing. So many systems aren't working as they normally do right now, which means radical shifts in work, school, and home life that almost none of us have experience with. Even those who have worked in disaster recovery or served in the military are facing a different kind of uncertainty right now. I think we maybe underestimate how severe the adversity is, and that people may be experiencing a normal reaction to a pretty severe and ongoing, unfolding, cascading disaster, Maston says. It's important to recognize that it's normal in a situation of great uncertainty and chronic stress to get exhausted and to feel ups and downs, to feel like you're depleted or experience periods of burnout. Research on disaster and trauma focuses mainly on what's helpful for people during the recovery period, but we're not close to recovery yet. People can use their surge capacity for acute periods, but when dire circumstances drag on, Maston says, you have to adapt a different style of coping. Understanding ambiguous loss. It's not surprising that, as a lifelong overachiever, I felt particularly despondent and adrift as the months have dragged on, says Pauline Boss, Ph.D., a family therapist and professor emeritus of social sciences at the University of Minnesota, who specializes in ambiguous loss. It's harder for high achievers, she says. The more accustomed you are to solving problems, to getting things done, to having a routine, the harder it will be on you because none of that is possible right now. You get feelings of hopelessness and helplessness, and those aren't good. That's similar to how Michael Mattis, M.D., a professor of thoracic surgery at the University of Minnesota, felt when he became addicted to prescription narcotics after undergoing several surgeries. Now recovered and a motivational speaker who promotes the idea of a resilience bank account, Mattis had always been a fast-moving high achiever, until he couldn't be. I realized that my personal operating system, though it had led me to tremendous success, had failed me on a more personal level, he says. I had to figure out a different way of contending with life. That mindset is an especially American one, Boss says. Our culture is very solution-oriented, which is a good way of thinking for many things, she says. It's partly responsible for getting a man on the moon and a rover on Mars and all the things we've done in this country that are wonderful. But it's a very destructive way of thinking when you're faced with a problem that has no solution, at least for a while. That means reckoning with what's called ambiguous loss, any loss that's unclear or lacks a resolution. It can be physical, such as a missing person, or the loss of a limb or organ, or psychological, such as a family member with dementia or a serious addiction. In this case, it's a loss of a way of life, of the ability to meet up with your friends and extended family, Boss says. It is perhaps a loss of trust in our government. It's the loss of our freedom to move about in our daily life as we used to. It's also the loss of high-quality education, or the overall educational experience we're used to, given school closures, modified openings, and virtual schooling. It's the loss of rituals, such as weddings, graduations, and funerals, and even lesser rituals, such as going to the gym. One of the toughest losses for me to adapt to is no longer doing my research and writing in coffee shops as I've done for most of my life, dating back to junior high. These were all things we were attached to and fond of, and they're gone right now, so the loss is ambiguous. It's not a death, but it's a major, major loss, says Boss. What we used to have has been taken away from us. Just as painful are losses that may result from the intersection of the pandemic and the already tense political division in this country. For many people, issues related to COVID-19 have become the last straw in ending relationships, whether it's a family member refusing to wear a mask, a friend promoting the latest conspiracy theory, or a coworker insisting COVID-19 deaths are exaggerated. Ambiguous loss elicits the same experiences of grief as a more tangible loss: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. But managing it often requires a bit of creativity. A winding, uncharted path to coping in a pandemic. While there isn't a handbook for functioning during a pandemic, Maston, Boss, and Mattis offered some wisdom for meandering our way through this. Accept that life is different right now. Mattis's approach involves radical acceptance. It's a shitty time. It's hard, he says. You have to accept that in your bones and be okay with this as a tough day, with that's the way it is, and accept that as a baseline. But that acceptance doesn't mean giving up, he says. It means not resisting or fighting reality so that you can apply your energy elsewhere. It allows you to step into a more spacious mental space that allows you to do things that are constructive, instead of being mired in a state of psychological self-torment. Expect less from yourself. Most of us have heard for most of our lives to expect more from ourselves in some way or another. Now we must give ourselves permission to do the opposite. We have to expect less of ourselves, and we have to replenish more, Maston says. I think we're in a period of a lot of self-discovery. Where do I get my energy? What kind of downtime do I need? That's all shifted right now, and it may take some reflection and self-discovery to find out what rhythms of life do I need right now. She says people are having to live their lives without the support of so many systems that have partly or fully broken down, whether it's schools, hospitals, churches, family support, or other systems that we relied on. We need to recognize that we're grieving multiple losses while managing the ongoing impact of trauma and uncertainty. The malaise so many of us feel, a sort of disinterested boredom, is common in research on burnout, Maston says. But other emotions accompany it: disappointment, anger, grief, sadness, exhaustion, stress, fear, anxiety. And no one can function at full capacity with all that going on. Recognize the different aspects of grief. The familiar stages of grief don't actually occur in linear stages, Boss says, but denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance are all major concepts in facing loss. Plenty of people are in denial, denying the virus is real, or that the numbers of cases or deaths are as high as reported, or that masks really help reduce disease transmission. Anger is evident everywhere. Anger at those in denial, anger in the race demonstrations, anger at those not physically distancing or wearing masks, and even anger at those who wear masks or require them. The bargaining, Boss says, is mostly with scientists that we hope will develop a vaccine quickly. The depression is obvious, but acceptance? I haven't accepted any of this, Boss says. I don't know about you. Sometimes acceptance means saying we're going to have a good time in spite of this, Boss says, such as when my family drove an hour outside the city to get far enough from light pollution to look at the comet Neowise. But it can also mean accepting that we cannot change the situation right now. We can kick and scream and be angry, or we can feel the other side of it with no motivation, difficulty focusing, lethargy, Boss says. Or we can take the middle way and just have a couple of days where you feel like doing nothing and you embrace the losses and sadness you're feeling right now. And then the next day, do something that has an element of achievement to it. Experiment with both and thinking. This approach may not work for everyone, but Boss says there's an alternative to binary thinking that many people find helpful in dealing with ambiguous loss. She calls it both and thinking. And sometimes it means embracing a bit of the irrational. For the families of soldiers missing in action in Vietnam that Boss studied early in her career, or the family members of victims of plane crashes where the bodies aren't recovered, this type of thinking means thinking, he is both living and maybe not. She is probably dead, but maybe not. If you stay in the rational when nothing else is rational, like right now, then you'll stress yourself more, she says. What I say with ambiguous loss is, the situation is crazy, not the person. The situation is pathological, not the person. An analogous approach during the pandemic might be, this is terrible and many people are dying, and this is also a time for our families to come closer together, Boss says. On a more personal level, I'm highly competent and right now, I'm flowing with the tide day to day. It's a bit of a Schrodinger's existence, but when you can't change the situation, the only thing you can change is your perception of it, she says. Of course, that doesn't mean denying the existence of the pandemic or the coronavirus. As Mattis says, you have to face reality, but how we frame that reality mentally can help us cope with it. Look for activities, new and old, that continue to fulfill you. Lots of coping advice has focused on self-care, but one of the frustrating ironies of the pandemic is that so many of our self-care activities have also been taken away. Pedicures, massages, coffee with friends, a visit to the amusement park, a kickboxing class, swimming in the local pool. These activities remain unsafe in much of the country, so we have to get creative with self-care when we're least motivated to get creative. When we're focused to rethink our options and broaden out what we think of as self-care, sometimes that constraint opens new ways of living and thinking, Mastin says. We don't have a lot of control over the global pandemic, but we do over our daily lives. You can focus on plans for the future and what's meaningful in life. For me, Since I missed eating in restaurants and was tired of our same old dinners, I began subscribing to a meal kit service. I hate cooking, but the meal kits were easy, and I was motivated by the chance to eat something that tasted more like what I'd order in a restaurant without having to invest energy in looking through recipes or ordering the right ingredients. Okay, I've also been playing a lot of Animal Crossing, but Mattis explains why it makes sense that creative activities like cooking, gardening, painting, house projects, or even building your own imaginary island out of pixels can be fulfilling right now. He references the book The Molecule of More, which explores how dopamine influences our experiences and happiness in describing the types of activities most likely to bring us joy. There are two ways the brain deals with the world: the future and things we need to go after, and the here and now, seeing things and touching things, Mattis says. Rather than being at the mercy of what's going on, we can use the elements of our natural reward system and construct things to do that are good no matter what. Those kind of activities have a planning element and a here and now experience element. For Mattis, for example, it was simply replacing all the shower heads and light bulbs in the house. It's a silly thing, but it made me feel good, he says. Focus on maintaining and strengthening important relationships. The biggest protective factors for facing adversity and building resilience are social support and remaining connected to people, Mastin says. That includes helping others, even when we're feeling depleted ourselves. Helping others is one of those win-win strategies of taking action, because we're all feeling a sense of helplessness and loss of control about what's going on with this pandemic. But when you take action with other people, you can control what you're doing, she says. Helping others could include checking in on family, friends, or buying groceries for an elderly neighbor. Begin slowly building your resilience bank account. Mattis's idea of a resilience bank account is gradually building into your life regular practices that promote resilience and provide a fallback when life gets tough. Though it would obviously be nice to have a fat account already, he says it's never too late to start. The areas he specifically advocates focusing on are sleep, nutrition, exercise, meditation, self-compassion, gratitude, connection, and saying no. Start really small and work your way up, he says. If you do a little bit every day, it starts to add up and you get momentum, even if you miss a day and then start again. We have to be gentle with ourselves and keep on. Begin again. After spending an hour on the phone with each of these experts, I felt refreshed and inspired. I can do this. I was excited about writing this article and sharing what I'd learned. And then it took me 2 weeks to start the article and another week to finish it, even though I wanted to write it. But now I could cut myself a little more slack for taking so much longer than I might have a few months ago. I might have intellectually accepted back in March that the next 2 years or more are going to be nothing like normal, and not even predictable in how they won't be normal. But cognitively recognizing and accepting that fact and emotionally incorporating that reality into everyday life aren't the same. Our new normal is always feeling a little off balance, like trying to stand in a dinghy on rough seas and not knowing when the storm will pass. But humans can get better at anything with practice. So at least I now have some ideas for working on my sea legs. Here's our next article, which was originally written for businesses, but can certainly be applied in everyday life. One note before we begin, this article was written back in March at the beginning of the pandemic. So please keep that in mind as we're reading this. I'm going to condense this article and read only the portions that can be applied to our lives and leave out the parts that are specifically written for businesses. Leading Beyond the Blizzard, Why Every Organization is Now a Startup, by Andy Crouch, Kurt Kelhacker, and Dave Blanchard. Andy Crouch is Partner for Theology and Culture at Praxis. Kurt Kelhacker is Chairman of the Board of Praxis, as well as Managing Partner at Elementum Ventures, a seed stage venture capital firm. Dave Blanchard is Co-Founder and CEO of Praxis. March 20th, 2020. Summary. 1. The novel coronavirus is not just something for leaders to get through for a few days or weeks. Instead, we need to treat COVID-19 as an economic and cultural blizzard, winter, and beginning of a little ice age, a once-in-a-lifetime change that is likely to affect our lives and organizations for years. We're not going back to normal. If you're a leader in an organization, it is time to rewrite your vision deck, that presentation so many organizations have that summarizes who you are, whom you serve, why you serve them, and what you do and how to do it. In this essay, we will explain why we think that for most organizations, businesses, nonprofits, and even churches, this is a time to urgently redesign our work in light of what we believe is not just a weeks-long blizzard, not even just a months-long winter, but something closer to the beginning of a 12 to 18-month ice age in which many assumptions and approaches must change for good. Almost all of us can and should keep the first three or four slides in our deck. Everything else needs to be reevaluated. The Blizzard. Michael Osterholm, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Minnesota, has spoken about the blizzard view of the current crisis. This is, in our judgment, the way the majority of Americans are currently responding to COVID-19 and the restrictive measures put in place by public health officials. To treat the crisis as a blizzard is to acknowledge that things are very difficult, to provide emotional and practical support for immediate needs, and to urge people to take extraordinary measures that not only would be unthinkable in ordinary times, but are unsustainable for long periods of time. If the crisis generated by COVID-19 is a blizzard, it will be over soon. We will all emerge from our shelter and resume life roughly the way it was before. Our job in a blizzard is to wait it out. Indeed, because of the nature of this crisis is currently fully visible only in hospitals in a handful of U.S. cities, and more distantly in places like Italy and Wuhan, China, places where frontline workers are utterly overwhelmed with work and fatigue, too much so to communicate with the outside world. There are many people, though fewer every day, who need to be convinced that a blizzard is upon us. A great deal of leadership effort has been expended, and still needs to be expended, to convince Americans that an acute, urgent crisis requires their immediate action. The problem is that there is almost no one working in public health, certainly not Osterholm, who believes a blizzard is an adequate way to understand this crisis. Instead, Osterholm has said in several interviews, we should be thinking in terms of the beginning of winter. Winter. Winter might begin with a blizzard, but it has a season lasting months, not a single event. In cold climates, winter means that periodic acute events, blizzards, punctuate a continuous period in which human activity must adapt to bitterly inhospitable conditions. This is almost certainly the reality of COVID-19 in the United States and many other countries. This will not be an event lasting a few weeks. The President of the United States, advised by widely respected public health experts, including Drs. Anthony Fauci and Deborah L. Birx, stated on March 16th that Americans should expect measures to combat the spread of the virus to last through July or August. Although for the moment federal and local officials are issuing orders and guidance with time horizons between 2 and 3 weeks, for shelter-in-place instructions in many localities, to 8 weeks, the CDC guidance for the cancellation of public events. No one should imagine that the COVID-19 season will have ended in this time frame, certainly not on a national scale. New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo has stated that cases in New York City will not peak for 45 days, around May 1st. But New York City, along with Seattle and the San Francisco Bay Area, is considerably ahead of other regions of the country, which will likely see the same exponential growth of cases in coming weeks. As the president and his advisors stated, Americans should expect that drastic measures will be necessary for the next 4 to 5 months, not weeks. As with winter weather, there will be regional variation. For one thing, the most extreme forms of social distancing, such as the order in San Diego County issued on March 17th that seemed to prohibit gathering in groups of any size outside of family or household units, and the most recent executive orders in California and New York, have never been attempted for months on end. They are blizzard-level responses. These measures should certainly have an effect on the number of new cases, including critical cases, to some extent flattening the curve and relieving some stress on regional health care systems. As the curve flattens, the pressure on officials to lift the most drastic restrictions will be intense. Appropriately so, because such isolation is extremely difficult for human beings to bear and carries its own risks of illness and mortality. The bottom line is that even as we weather the current blizzard and convince others that a blizzard is upon us, all of us should be preparing for a winter in which countless aspects of our society are reconfigured. Even in the mild weeks, life will be radically different from what it was just a few weeks ago. And as with winter in the northern U.S., at any time a storm could arise that brings life entirely to a halt. Coping with this all by itself would be a huge challenge for leaders, but our counsel and our plan for the organizations we lead and work with is to prepare for a third reality as well. The Little Ice Age. The year 1816 is known as the Year Without a Summer. The Wikipedia entry on the subject begins. The eruption of Mount Tambora in what is now Indonesia led to a worldwide ash plume that reduced solar radiation, causing widespread crop failures and unprecedentedly cold temperatures, with frosts recorded across Europe and North America even in the summer months. 1816 came toward the end of what is known to climatologists as the Little Ice Age, a several-century-long reduction in temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere that shaped European history in profound ways. The metaphor is obvious. Just as winter is more chronic and long-lasting than a blizzard and requires different sorts of adaption, which are in many ways more far-reaching than merely hunkering down for a few days or weeks, so there are even larger-scale events that reshape the climate through countless successive seasons. The Little Ice Age lasted perhaps 300 years. No one expects the effects of COVID-19 will be of this magnitude. We have the inestimable gift of modern medicine, as well as systems of communication and coordination that almost certainly will allow our world to mitigate the direct effects of the virus within a few years. The Spanish flu lasted from 1918 to 1920 in an era before the existence of effective testing or vaccines. This would seem to be a worst-case upper bound for COVID-19 as well. A generally accepted time frame for the wide deployment of an effective vaccine, though there are huge uncertainties here, is 18 months. But 18 months is not a season. It is, for many purposes, more like an ice age or an era. What are the reasons for thinking we are entering such an extended year without a summer? On Monday, March 16th, one of the world's most eminent scientific teams, based at Imperial College London, released a rigorous paper modeling the likely effects of non-pharmaceutical interventions in flattening the curve of COVID-19 in the United Kingdom and the United States. Though parts of the paper are technical, every single leader of any organization of any size should take the time to read the paper and grasp its essential arguments. A key bottom line of the paper is simply stated, any measures that successfully flatten the curve in the coming weeks or months will also extend the curve further out. To the extent we are able to rescue our healthcare system from total breakdown immediately, that will come at the cost of creating the cultural and economic conditions of winter, likely through the end of 2021, until the population gradually and naturally acquires immunity, at the cost of widespread illness and death, or a vaccine is developed. Furthermore, though it may be possible to lift the most extreme measures, at least for short periods of time, any meaningful impact on the disease burden will require vast, sustained changes in social behavior. Epidemiologically speaking, we are most likely facing a blizzard today, a winter for the next few months, and a little ice age for years. And that is if we succeed in suppressing or containing the virus enough to avert a catastrophic failure of the healthcare system this spring and summer with many millions of deaths, both from COVID-19 and other critical causes for lack of health care. And I'm going to end this very long article at this point, which as it begins to focus more on businesses and how they are reacting. It's likely that we're not going to be able to complete all of the articles that we had been looking at for this hour, so I'm going to skip to the last article that we had intended to read. This is from the Washington Post. Who is handling the pandemic best emotionally? Boomers and other retirees. Younger generations are more acutely feeling angst from the pandemic. By Daryl Austin. Published September 11th. The emotional toll of the coronavirus pandemic is steep for most everyone, but it turns out that one group is handling it better than the rest, retirees. That might seem counterintuitive, since the virus is more dangerous for older people. But studies looking at mental health in the pandemic show that retirees who live at home are free from two of the stressors that are squeezing their younger counterparts: job security and parenting children as they navigate at-home learning in isolation. My life hasn't changed all that much, said Clayton Tanner, 71, a retired banker who lives in Hurricane, Utah. Tanner, who teaches part-time at a boys' school to supplement his Social Security income, says the biggest changes in his life since the pandemic hit are not being able to go to church on Sundays and observing the social distancing measures the school put in place. Younger generations are feeling angst from the pandemic more acutely. According to a study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, younger adults are among those who have experienced disproportionately worse mental health outcomes, increased substance use, and elevated suicidal ideation during the pandemic. People who were already juggling daycare or raising children while simultaneously establishing careers have had their lives upended on nearly every front. Many now work at home while also tending to their children or send their kids to daycare while hand-wringing about the safety of it. Young people without children often feel they are bearing the burden of extra assignments from work to pick up the slack. The CDC study found that 46% of people ages 18 to 24 report experiencing pandemic-related anxiety and stress disorder. That number dropped steadily as people age, with just 9% of people 65 and older reporting pandemic-related despair. Another study, this one from the financial services company Edward Jones and think tank AgeWave, surveyed more than 9,000 people across the United States and Canada and found that 39% of the silent generation, those age 75 or older, and 33% of boomers reported they were faring very well when asked how they were coping emotionally during the pandemic. That number decreased to 29% for Generation X and to 26% for millennials. On the other end of the spectrum, 24% of millennials ages 24 to 39 answered the same question that they were not well, compared with 15% for Gen Xers, ages 40 to 55, and Boomers, ages 56 to 74. Only 5% of the Silent Generation said they weren't faring well. Most retirees are no longer worried about losing their job or helping their school kids cope with learning from home, said Ken Deichwald, president and CEO of AgeWave. Pre-retirees, on the other hand, are getting the wind knocked out of them right now. On social media, comments such as exhausted, overwhelmed, depressed, and pushed over the edge came from a group of 20-something to 40-something men and women in response to how they were holding up. I've been working through severe depression that I've never experienced before now, said Kimberly Jones, 32, mother of three in Spanish Fork, Utah, who now works from home for a paint and glass company. She said the pressure of her husband losing his job and her young children being mostly homebound caused her to be put on suicide watch. Another woman, Patty Johnston, 37, a stay-at-home mother of three in Idaho Falls, Idaho, said her alopecia recently flared up from anxiety. I ended up losing about two-thirds of my hair, she said. The enormous caveat, of course, is that older people in assisted living facilities are under the most stress of all. For those living in nursing homes and similar situations, it's been a terrible nightmare, Deichwald said. Older generations are definitely feeling vulnerable because of the likelihood of contagion and its serious consequences. Karistan Conan, a professor of psychiatric epidemiology at Harvard University's School of Public Health, said the fear of getting sick is a stress factor for younger and middle-aged adults as well, but for some, that may be more abstract than many of the more practical day-to-day challenges of paying bills, working, and tending to children. A study from the University of British Columbia found that its 776 participants, younger adults, were struggling more from the pandemic, in part because they were in a time in their lives with more responsibilities. Younger and middle-aged adults were more concerned about their finances, losing their job, and not reaching an important goal, said Patrick Kleiber, one of the researchers who worked on that study. Eric Berman, a clinical psychologist at the National Institute of Mental Health, said her findings about pandemic stress were similarly based in part on age. She emphasized that younger generations may also be experiencing a larger number of stressors at one time. Anxiety often finds its fuel in uncertainty, and this is very true during these uncertain times, she said, adding that it may be possible that older adults are more accustomed to dealing with uncertainty, and getting used to uncertainty does help people learn how to cope. In fact, Tanner, the retired banker, said he has the benefit of life experience to rely on. I've survived recessions and depressions and the polio pandemic that took the life of two of my cousins and partially crippled my sister, Tanner said. Elena Mann, a pediatrician in Brooklyn, New York, said in addition to less life experience, young and middle-aged adults now often find themselves stalled as they are trying to establish themselves. This stage of life usually includes developing crucial components of identity, financial and living independence, professional and social connections, and the pursuit of individual interests and passions, Mann said. Instead, these critical steps that bring importance and a meaning to life at that age have been disrupted. She suggested that parents seek professional help if they or their kids are struggling. One of the positive outcomes of the pandemic is that effective mental help is now more widely available virtually, she said. Conan, the professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, suggested one way millennials and Gen Xers can better cope with feeling overwhelmed. Acknowledge none of this is normal, Conan said. We are in a global pandemic. Calibrate expectations to be realistic to your situation. If you're juggling too much, relaxing some of your rules might make things more manageable. Kleiber, who worked on the University of British Columbia study, said younger generations can learn from their older counterparts, many of whom are taking time to Zoom with old friends and spend time outdoors. Older adults, for example, were more likely to spend time in nature or to create positive social interactions remotely, he said. Berman addressed the benefits of unplugging from time to time if possible, even if it seems like an impossibility with all of the responsibilities on their shoulders. Don't forget that it's also important to find times when you can shut down the computer and put away the phone, she said. Immerse yourself in a hobby. Do whatever it is that allows you to rest and recharge. Dylan G., an assistant professor of psychology at Yale University, suggests other anxiety-reducing habits for young adults that might seem obvious but make a big difference, including exercise, maintaining a consistent schedule, and getting adequate sleep. Above all, G advises that people not be too hard on themselves, regardless of which generation they're a part of. Nobody is going to be at their best during a global pandemic. Just acknowledging this fact can be helpful and validating. We need to be compassionate with ourselves. For the remainder of our time, we have three short pre-recorded stories. This first from NPR is kind of about getting out in nature, as some of the earlier articles suggested we do. Scientists find the quiet of pandemic shutdowns have made birds change their tunes.
For decades, songbirds in big cities have been raising their voices to be heard above the noise.
This is kind of like a cocktail party. When you go to a party, as people show up, it gets louder and louder, and you also get louder, right? Because you're trying to be heard above that din.
Liz Derryberry of the University of Tennessee. She has been studying that phenomenon in white-crowned sparrows in the San Francisco Bay Area.
They're cute, round little birds, says Derryberry's colleague, Jenny Phillips of Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
They've got a kind of gray and brown body, and then they have these black and white racing stripes on their head. And they do love to sing, so they do attract attention to themselves in that way.
As the pandemic began and traffic and city noise went way down, the scientists wondered, how would big city birds respond?
Well, Phillips had some earlier recordings of the sparrows taken near the Golden Gate Bridge in 2016. If you listen closely, you can just hear the birds tweeting through the traffic. Yeah, you can hear that.
I can. Well, in April of this year, Phillips hopped on her bike with some audio gear and recorded the birds again at the same spot.
Okay, even though that song sounds much clearer to the ear, after analyzing the recordings, the scientists say the city's songbirds are actually singing at lower volumes today because they're not fighting to be heard.
And for those feathered virtuosos, singing more quietly means you can add more flourish. Here's Derryberry again.
Because there's so much less noise, they can sort of expand their song and fill that soundscape, which is higher performance.
The work appears today in the journal Science.
David Luther of George Mason University also worked on the study. He says a better song could, in theory, go a long way.
They're better able to defend a territory from some other male, and they're better able to attract a mate, or possibly several mates.
Derryberry puts it another way.
Bird songs were sexier in the city.
I think we're going to need more research on that to see if maybe the birds agree.
So maybe now would be a good time to get back into nature, go outside and listen to the birds. Maybe go to the Sibley Nature Center, or to a park, or just outside in the yard. Now, a couple of reports about what you can do inside. This first one is tips for homebound declutterers.
With so many people spending a lot more time at home during the pandemic, there's plenty of time to reconsider all the stuff we accumulate in our houses and apartments. You know, that closet that won't close, that pile of papers that needs filing, maybe even an elderly parent's house that you know needs some attention. We called Julie Hall to get some tips on how to declutter. She is the director of the American Society of Estate Liquidators, and she's got a new book out called Inheriting Clutter. Hall says the COVID-19 related lockdowns have been a catalyst for house cleanings.
And so one of the biggest problems with that is, what do you do with all the stuff? because we've accumulated it not only for ourselves, but from previous generations. So right now we're definitely seeing an uptick in this particular trend.
And Hall says different generations tend to have trouble parting with different sorts of things.
For example, our depression era generation, their problem seems to be paper. They really didn't trust a lot of people. So they have receipts from, you know, the 1940s, and they've kept everything that you can imagine, catalogs, magazines, and it is time to let some of those things go and begin the thinning out process. For other generations, I'm a boomer, and I think the pain point for my generation is we have an emotional pull. We feel an obligation to our parents and these items that they cherish so much. But then our children, they don't want these items. So truly, we are the sandwich because we don't know what to do.
Hall says in her experience, millennials tend to have a more straightforward relationship with clutter. They don't want any. Still, she has this advice for people of all ages. Start with the easy stuff, like getting rid of that pile of old magazines in the corner.
Or let's step into the kitchen for a moment, where under the sink is an ice cream maker from circa 1962 that hasn't worked since 1963. And, you know, we've got the Cool Whip containers and the pie tins and the mayonnaise jars. Okay, I understand that that generation wanted to use those things, but they don't need to fill up the cabinets. I think in one kitchen we counted 93 water glasses. And you just don't need that. So that's a great place to start too.
Can I ask you, again, like I said, it's a more complex topic than it maybe it seems on the surface, because stuff isn't just stuff to people, right? Their stuff isn't just stuff. How do you handle the emotions that people go through when it comes to parting with stuff?
Well, I've had to go through this personally. You know, I became a widow quite suddenly. So I lost my parents suddenly. So I had to learn how to do this myself. And, you know, the emotional part, I think that sorting through items is very healing when someone's grieving. And I think it's really important, whether you're not grieving, in a way, it's still grief because it's your life and you're letting go of a lot of these things and you're welcoming in a new chapter. So for me, the key has always been to make peace with the items I'm letting go of. And I hold it and I look at it and I say, do I like you? Yes, I do. But do I love you? No, I don't. And if I don't absolutely love it and cherish it, I take a picture of it and I let it go.
Decluttering tips from Julie Hall. She is the author of Inheriting Clutter.
And after your living space is decluttered, you could relax, perhaps, with a book. From Friday, here's a report from NPR about their favorite new audiobooks.
Yes, you may be stir crazy during the pandemic, but it's not because there's a lack of personal entertainment options. I mean, come on, you can watch, read, and listen to just about anything right now, including audiobooks. Some people devour them, and some people would if they knew where to start, which is where I'm at. And this is why we have NPR pop culture critic Linda Holmes with us for some audiobook recommendations. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Rachel.
I want to understand, like, because people aren't commuting as much, which is when I would imagine people listen to audiobooks. I mean, when is it happening? When is it happening for you?
Yeah, I just listen whenever, honestly. For me, audiobooks are not primarily about convenience. They're not about times when I can't read on the page. They're about the separate pleasures of a great narrator performing a great book. And a lot of the time, I will choose them over reading on the page. And so to demonstrate to you, you're going to understand what I'm saying. It's going to make perfect sense. I'm going to play you a clip of my favorite audiobook of all time. This is the actor Bobby Cannavale performing the Richard Price New York crime novel, Lush Life.
At the same hour, two night watch detectives crossed the chipped octagonal tile of the front foyer of 27 Eldridge, then began trudging up the saddle-backed marble stairs to the top floor to begin their canvas. There were three apartments to a floor, each with its own paint-slathered, century-old husk of a mezuzah, the front doors painted the same dull carmine as the embossed T tin that line the bottom half of the stairways.
I love it.
I love that performance. It is a New York crime novel made flesh, and it is so entertaining to me. I've loved that one since I first listened to it.
Okay, so other than that, what are your audiobook recommendations?
Well, if you know me, you know that I love a good romance novel. You know this about me, Rachel.
That's and true.
My most recent favorite is a book called Red, White, and Royal Blue. It's by Casey McQuiston. The audiobook is read by Ramon Dale.